Hi everyone. The title of my talk is Fermi Surface Topology and Chirality in Wild Semimetals. I'm an experimentalist, so I am actually looking for bulk signatures of wild fermions in experiments. Okay, that. So first, I would like to thank my collaborators. There's quite a few people who worked with me. The quantum oscillation measurements were done by my postdoc and my PhD student, Frank Arnold, who you see here, and Marcel Naumann. Then magnetoresistance measurements were mainly carried out by these people. Band structure calculations were done by Bing Haiyan and his group. From Claudia Felser's department, and the samples were grown by Markus Schmidt. We also had theoretical support by people from the neighboring institute in Dresden, Adolfo and Jens. Okay, the outline of my talk is the following. I will talk about the Fermi surface of tantalum phosphide and tantalum arsenide. That we have determined with our quantum oscillation measurements. And I will also talk a bit about the current jetting that was just mentioned and what we found about that. Okay, I have a very basic introduction, but maybe it's helpful for some students. So wild fermions are relativistic particles that were predicted by Weil in 29. And the Hamiltonian looks like this. They are the massless solution of the Dirac equation. This Hamiltonian basically has two properties. It has a linear dispersion, and also it has this chirality given by the sign. Sigma here is the vector of Pauli matrices, and the chirality depends on whether the spin is aligned parallel or antiparallel to the momentum. Now, in a semi-metal, you can have fermions which behave like wild fermions when you have these linear band crossings in the band structure. So when they are degenerate, we talk about Dirac semi-metals, and these are 3D Dirac cones. And when they are non-degenerate, we talk about the wild semimetals. The second property of chirality comes from the spin structure. So if you have a strong spin orbit coupling, you get the spins which are aligned in parallel or antiparallel to the momentum, and then you get these all spins pointing in or spins pointing out to these nodes. And these Weil nodes always come in pairs. We have heard that. So the main experimental signatures of Weil fermions, I have only two, but there is more. First one is the Fermi arcs. These were all discovered experimentally with ARPIS measurements in the family of materials that I'm interested in. So these measurements confirmed that these semi-metals are really wild semi-metals. The second one is the chiral anomaly that we've just heard about, and this leads to a negative longitudinal magnetoresistance in these materials. There's also a lot of results reporting this negative longitudinal magnetoresistance. Basically in all of those materials that I'm interested in, also in sodium-3 bismuth and this compound and this. These are Dirac semimetals, and also in the Häusler compound, gadolinium-platinum-bismuth, which is not a wild semimetal in zero field. But also in a material, maybe that's even the nicest example, you have a very clear negative magnetoresistance to -100% in tantalum arsenate 2, which is not at all a wild semimetal. Okay, just because we're talking about bulk measurements, I want to come to this schematic comparison of normal semi-metals and wild semi-metals. In normal semi-metals, you have very small pockets of holes and electrons. Examples are bismuth or antimony or this compound. You have a low carrier density, very small effective masses, high mobilities, and usually these systems are compensated. And this leads to the fact that you get a very high transverse magnetoresistance. In a wild semi-metal, the band structure looks quite similar. You have these small pockets. The difference is that at least one of the pockets is composed by a band stemming from this linear dispersion from the Weyl node. Now, if we look at bulk properties, we're only sensitive to a very small region around the Fermi energy. That is the difference to ARPIS measurement, which are sensitive to all this region below the Fermi energy. And actually, in this small region, these two materials look very similar. And what I mean by that is that to first order, this band also could be seen as linear dispersion. And so the question I'm asking is, how far are the Weyl nodes from the Fermi energy, and do we expect to see experimental signatures of the Weyl nodes, even if they are far away or not? Now, these are the materials I'm looking at, especially tantalum arsenide and tantalum phosphide. They were predicted to be topological Weyl semi-metals 2 years ago, and they have this crystal structure without inversion symmetry. And especially, you can grow really nice single crystals of several millimeters of size. So how can we get the Weyl nodes in these materials? They have these mirror planes. And if you do the band structure calculation without spin orbit coupling, you see that there's a band inversion along these nodal rings, which lie on the mirror planes. And then when you include the spin orbit coupling, these rings are gapped out, and there's only band crossings, point-like band crossings, which are left. So here you see that the spin up and spin, that's in the scheme, spin up and spin down bands split up because of spin orbit coupling and the broken inversion symmetry. And actually have two types of these crossing points, W2 and W1. Now, if your Fermi energy lies here, close to the Weyl nodes, you directly see that you get two Fermi surface pockets, one around each Weyl node, and they have a well-defined chirality, because here all the spins are pointing out, and here all the spins are pointing in. Now, if your Fermi energy is a bit too far up, then you get a single Fermi surface, including the pair, and then chirality is not well-defined anymore. You rather get just a spin-polarized Fermi surface pocket. And that is actually what we want to find out in our experiment. Now, it's a bit more complicated because you have these two types of Weyl nodes. So you have, even if you're close to one type of Weyl node, you will always have normal electrons also in your Fermi surface. Okay, now I first want to show results on tantalum phosphide. Here you see quantum oscillations in the magnetization, plotted as 1 over B. We measured the temperature dependence, and we measured the effective masses by that. They are pretty small, so very typical for a semi-metal. The mobility is quite high, and the mean free path is long, so the crystals are nice, and we get several frequencies. Now, we did that for all orientations of the magnetic field with respect to the crystal axis. So we measured also resistivity and torque on several samples. And we established the complete angular dependence of the oscillation frequencies. And this So the experimental points are given here, and the lines are what we get from the calculations when we tune the Fermi level slightly to have the best agreement. So actually the Fermi surface looks like this. It consists of two bananas, one electron and one hole. And it is quite surprising that the experiments confirm even very tiny properties of or shapes of these Fermi surfaces. So for example, these small humps that you see here, they make appear an extra oscillation frequency, an orbit which appears here, a maximum orbit, and this is this one which goes down when the field turns. And yeah, what is also interesting is that in this compound, we measured several batches and several samples, and the oscillation frequencies do not change between one sample to the other. So the chemical potential really seems to be quite stable. Now, in the Brillouin zone, these Fermi surfaces lie like this. Actually, they lie along the nodal rings that we've seen before. And what is most important is that they include these pairs of wild nodes. Okay, so here, in this compound, you do not have a well-defined chirality. Now, if you look at the energy of the Fermi level, the red line here gives the Fermi level of the compensated, perfectly compensated material, if you calculate the volumes. And we see that our Fermi level is slightly higher. So it's an slightly electron-doped system, only 5 MeV above the charge neutral point, and this is in agreement with our measurements of the Hall effect. You also see that the Fermi energy is in between the range where we see, where we would expect to have separate Fermi surface pockets around the wild nodes. These are given here by the gray shaded areas here. Okay. And the distance, maybe I could say that, the distance of the Fermi level to the wild point is 13 MeV. So it's not very far, but a bit far. So just as a summary on this compound, we have Fermi surface pockets including the pairs. So the chirality is not well defined. And I think we should not expect to see the chiral anomaly in this compound. However, we do see a negative magnetoresistance in some cases. So here is our measurements of the longitudinal magnetoresistance. You turn the angle of the magnetic field towards the direction of the current. And you see that when they are parallel, you see this nice negative magnetoresistance. And this is independent of which direction the current goes in the crystal. Now, we saw some strange things. We saw these negative magnetoresistances only for certain geometries of the sample and the contacts. And we also measured sometimes negative voltages. So we got a bit suspicious and we did some tests. So what we did is we took a sample here. The field is in line with the longest dimension of the sample. The current is injected here through these two points in the corner, and we put three voltage contact pairs. And actually, their behavior with increasing field is completely different. So that immediately tells you that the current distribution is not homogeneous in the sample. And the explanation is quite simple, but what you really have to keep in mind is that the transverse magnetoresistance, because they are compensated semimetals, is really high. So the transverse the resistance goes up by a factor of more than 120, or here even more than 160, in fields of 9 tesla. And now, if you have So say the field is zero. In zero field, you have an isotropic resistance, and you inject your current into, so here on this side, this is the material, and here you inject the current. This, it will distribute homogeneously to the whole sample. And the equipotential lines will form these circles. But if you put on the field, which is in this direction, the resistance perpendicular to the field will grow very much, and the resistance longitudinal to the field, parallel to the field, will be very much smaller, so the current will go mainly in the direction of the magnetic field. And what happens now is that in zero field, the current spreads through the whole cross-section of the sample, but as you increase the field, it concentrates more and more to the line connecting these current contacts. And now if you have a voltage pair on the surface of your sample, the voltage that you measure will decrease with magnetic field. So that's the current jetting effect. In the potential distribution, this looks like this. In zero field, you have almost parallel equipotential lines. And in very high magnetic fields, these lines get distorted and become ellipsoids. And this effect, okay, this really well explains our data. So for the voltage contact pair, which is farthest away from the current path, you see this strong decrease. But for the voltage pair, which is really close to the current path, you see this strong increase because the current concentrates near this contact pair. And actually, that's a very old effect. It was measured in bismuth, and in the same configuration, they really have very similar results. Okay, the equipotential lines in just to, we did these calculations of what we would expect if we have this effect to confirm that that's the case. So here we look at zero field where we have almost no anisotropy of the resistance. You have very nice parallel equipotential lines. And then at an anisotropy of 27 of transverse versus longitudinal resistance, you see that they're really strongly distorted, the equipotential lines. And then we also can calculate the field dependence of the voltage that we get just by taking into account the transverse resistance. So our intrinsic longitudinal resistance stays constant in field. There's no chiral anomaly. And this can really well reproduce the trend of our data. Now, we did that a bit more carefully to study this effect more. So here we studied niobium phosphide. This and the geometry is very much the same. Here you again have two very different signals, voltage as a function of field, for these two contact pairs. And this time we did finite element simulations. And here, the transverse magnetoresistance that we took to do these simulations grows even much more. It grows by a factor of 2,500 in fields of 9 tesla. So here, the current jetting effect is very, very strong. And you see that the current concentrates really on a very, very thin line between the current contacts. Now, the field dependence that we get, we do that by, okay, we do the analogy of anisotropy to field by just taking the transverse resistance. So this gives us the anisotropy. And then you see that basically the total signal is just an effect of the current jetting for both voltages. Now here, the anisotropy is so high that although the voltage pair 2 is very close to the current path, you also see the current decoupling from that pair, and it decreases strongly here. Now I come to the angular dependence. We measured the angular dependence for both pairs, but I would like to concentrate on this pair, which is the one just above the current contact. Now here you see that for very small misalignments of the field, so the field turned in that direction, we measure negative voltages. And I know that there's even papers published where they see negative voltages and they claim negative resistances. So if we look at the angular dependence of the signal as a function of the, at fixed field, you see these very sharp dips and humps. And this was also measured before 40 years ago in antimony in a simple similar geometry. And actually, you can very easily understand it. You have these potential mountains, and which point always in the direction of the magnetic field. So when your field from the current contact points to the opposite voltage contact, then you will get a negative voltage. So we can really correlate the angle of these dips and humps with the geometry of our sample. So we just calculate these angles here of the contact with respect to the voltage, current contacts. And what we get just from geometry is given by these arrows. And it agrees perfectly with the measurements. So to the question if there is a chiral anomaly. We cannot tell. Okay, our measurements are completely dominated by the current jetting, which is a general problem appearing in longitudinal magnetoresistance measurements when the resistance anisotropy changes in field. And this is true even for low anisotropies. So just to show you what I mean by that is for this voltage contact pair V2, so in the simulation, even very, very low field, so an anisotropy of 10 corresponds to 0.2 Tesla. And to 0.2 Tesla, we have a reduction of the voltage signal of 20% or so. So even for low anisotropies, that can be low fields or it can also be high temperatures. The current jetting explains naturally the field dependence of the measured signal. So this slight increase at the beginning and also the drop that many people see. It also explains naturally the angle dependence, which is different from E dot B. And when you do longitudinal magnetoresistance measurements, you always have to check very carefully. Maybe the chiral anomaly exists, but the measurements are not good enough yet to tell if it exists. Now I come to tantalum arsenide. We did the same game as in tantalum phosphide, so we measured quantum oscillation measurements. Here you see the raw signal of the magnetization. You see very nice oscillations. Then resistivity, and here's the Fourier transforms of the resistivity. Compared to other measurements, we saw two new oscillation frequencies. And again, we established the angular dependence. And here you also see the comparison with the theory. Now, to show you a bit more how we determine the Fermi and the Fermi level. Here I show you the expected quantum oscillation frequencies for a field along the c-axis from the band structure calculations as a function of the Fermi level. Okay, so as you increase the Fermi level, the hole pockets shrink and the electron pockets grow, of course. And we get several possible Fermi levels where the oscillation frequency that you expect agrees with the 7 Tesla frequency that we measure in experiment for this field direction. Now we calculate the angular dependence of the frequencies for all of these points. And we compare it to our measurements. So here, these are these 2 points where you hold doped. And you see that this is how the Fermi surface would look like in that case. And the lines are the angular dependence that you would get. So here the agreement is not so good. Now we go to these 2 points. Actually, that's the one we chose in the end. And this is 3 MeV higher, where the agreement for this pocket is a bit better, but the other two are worse. And that's the highly electron-doped pocket. Anyway, so that's how we tell that the Fermi energy is, again, about 6 MeV above the charge-neutral point. And if you wonder where this disagreement comes from, I will tell you in a minute. So here in that case, for tantalum arsenide, we have a Fermi surface where we have 2 Fermi surface pockets, one around each while node. Okay, and that is true for both W1 and W2 while points. Additionally, we have this small long hole pocket. And this is actually where we have to look at to explain this difference. In experiment, this frequency, the oscillation frequency, goes only down. And that is probably because this pocket in real, so in the calculation, it has a slight angle of 12 degrees to the A-axis. But in reality, I think it's rather very horizontal. When it's very horizontal, this frequency goes just down if you turn the field away from the C-axis. And that's what we see. Again, these pockets lie around this nodal ring. And here you see that we have separate Fermi surface pockets. And so the chirality is well defined in that compound. Now here again is the energy diagram, the dispersion near the while nodes. And you see that actually the distance from the Fermi energy to the while node is the same. But as it's on above it, it's in the region where you have separate pockets. And also the doping is really similar to tantalum phosphide and also in agreement with Hall measurements. Now, as we know, exactly which band is a while, so which pocket is a while pocket and which pocket is a trivial pocket, we can look at the Berry phase of each quantum oscillation and check if it agrees. And actually, so these are our data of magnetization divided by the field as a function of F over B. And I like this compared to Landau-Fan diagrams because you can see the phase shift immediately. So you normalize your 1 over B axis with the frequency, and then you can compare it to the theory. So when you look into the Schoenberg book, he gives you the curve that you expect for M over B as a function of F over B. And this is given here for normal electrons. And also there is a calculation by Ashby and Carbot where they calculate exactly this for while fermions. And you see that for the while fermions, the peaks are slightly to the left of these full indices. And for the normal electrons, they are slightly left of the half indices. And actually, for the field along the c-axis, we see mainly the 7 Tesla frequency, which comes from these two pockets. And here you see that the phase agrees very well with this calculation for Weyl fermions. Along the a-axis, the main signal we have is from the normal hole pocket. And here you see that the phase corresponds very well to this case of normal electrons in the Schönberg calculation. So that is actually the first thermodynamic evidence for the Berry phase in Weyl's hemimetals. Okay. Now I come to my summary. We have measured the Fermi surface of tantalum phosphide and tantalum arsenide. We have shown that chirality is ill-defined in tantalum phosphide because pairs of Weyl nodes are embedded in big Fermi surfaces. But in tantalum arsenide, we have the separate Weyl pockets. So we have a well-defined chirality. So we definitely want to go on and look for further signatures of Weyl fermions in tantalum arsenide. One of them is the Berry phase of the chiral pockets in this compound. And well, that's an issue that we try to resolve. Thank you.
Data for this tantalum arsenide?
Not without current jetting.
Not without.
We have tried to measure it. So there's two ways to get around the current jetting. One, of course, is to inject the current more homogeneously. The other one is to make very long, thin samples. We have tried to do so. Wait, let me check what. Okay. So we have tried to put not point contacts, but to put silver paint contacts over the whole cross-sectional surfaces of our samples, and we have done so for all, so niobium phosphide, tantalum phosphide, niobium arsenide, and tantalum arsenide. And actually, we found that it didn't help. The current just chose some contact point where the local resistance, contact resistance was small, and then it still did, so the current jetting was still there. So you see that the full lines are for point contacts, the dashed lines are for these silver paint better contacts, but the voltage still differs a lot we measure. So that's not trivial. Actually, if you read in the book by Pippert on magnetoresistance, he tells how it was done in bismuth to solve this problem. It's really amazing what they did. They put mercury, liquid mercury, at ambient temperature. Then they scratched underneath the mercury. And then they froze this whole thing down. And that's how they got the good contacts. Because in these semi-metals, soldering often doesn't work. It doesn't wet the material. Now, the second solution is to make very long and thin samples. But if you have very high resistance anisotropies, like in cadmium arsenide or or bismuth, then it's really hard. You would need very, very high long samples. Actually, the length that you need is proportional to square root of the anisotropy compared to the width, I mean. So if you have an anisotropy of 10,000, then you would need a sample which is 100 times longer than wide. So it's pretty hard to realize. And then even if you have a homogeneous current injection, you're very sensitive still to small misalignments, which will distort your potential lines or to bendings or holes in the sample. So
So since you have three sets of voltage leads, it seems like you can just measure the resistance and anisotropy just by cross wiring the voltage leads. And why haven't you done that?
I don't understand.
So you had basically six voltage leads, right?
Yes.
And so by not just combining V1, V2, V3, but you can actually cross-wire them, and then you can measure the anisotropic resistance that way, I think. And is there...
Well, the problem is the current doesn't flow at the voltage contact. It flows through the inside of the sample. So you cannot detect the longitudinal voltage like that, the intrinsic one. Longitudinal resistance, I mean.
Any more questions? Okay, well, let's thank Elena again. Now we have a short break, and we'll regroup here at 4:00.